From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The killing of George Floyd has sparked mass protests in Minneapolis, with thousands of people turning out onto the streets and police responding with stun grenades, rubber bullets, and tear gas. America has witnessed through smartphone video documentation yet another brutal murder of a black man at the hands of police. And although there has been a demand for black lives to matter for years now, will Floyd be yet another victim in the deadly toll of racist policing? Floyd's killing came to light at almost the same time as another incident unfolded in New York City's Central Park, which could have turned deadly but didn't. A liberal white woman named Amy Cooper called police falsely claiming that a black man was threatening her. The man in question, Christian Cooper, filmed the incident, exposing her lie. Tied to both incidents is the recent killing of a black jogger named Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia by a former police officer and his son, also captured on video. It is a part of a deadly and disturbing pattern that echoes throughout American history. My guest is Jody Armour. He is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, The Hidden Costs of Being Black in America. He's also Soros Justice Senior Fellow of the Open Societies Institute's Center on Crime, Communities, and Culture. And he is the Race and Criminal Justice Correspondent for our program. Welcome back, Jody.
Good to be back with you, Sonali.
So let's first talk about what's happening in Minneapolis, Minnesota. One thing that seems to be somewhat different about this latest tragedy is that we're not getting the same kind of questioning of police motives and the same kind of criminalization of the victim, at least at first glance, as we've seen in previous cases. People that seem to be far more willing to accept what they see with their eyes on the brutal video of George Floyd's killing. Do you agree?
Yeah, the video is so brutal and explicit, and the facts seem to so cry out for themselves, speak for themselves, that you are hearing less of that kind of pushback. But you may remember, Sonali, that in 1991, there was the Rodney King beating with the four officers who were videotaped beating Rodney King. It saturated the airwaves at the time. That seemed like an equally clear video, yet a jury, when they looked at that video in Simi Valley, acquitted all officers on all serious charges. And so even the most graphic video that seems to speak for itself most plainly doesn't always get interpreted the same way by different audiences. But you're right, so far there seems to be less demonizing of or stigmatizing of the victim and more of a willingness to say this is wrong. And one way you can see that is even the mayor of the city stepped up and said this was wrong in emphatic terms. The president of the University of Minnesota said we will not have Minnesota Police Department helping to police our functions and events going forward. So something about this case really does seem, Sonali, to have struck a nerve, a special chord with Americans of all of many different perspectives.
And of course, what's so critically important is video evidence, because America has not believed Black people when they've said that they have been unfairly brutalized. The police report in the case of George Floyd said that he physically resisted officers, and yet video footage from bystanders, including from a surveillance camera of a store there that captured the killing, showed absolutely no such thing. And so all police have ever had to do or felt like they could do in the past to get away with these sorts of things is to simply say that the victim resisted, the victim reached for what they thought was a gun. It's basically been police claiming whatever they feel like claiming and the justice system taking them at their word. But now we have people walking around with the ability to videotape any incident at a moment's notice, and the whole thing has fallen open.
Yeah, well, the credibility of police officers has been something that people have taken for granted. They've given them the benefit of the doubt, and they have refused to believe people who said things that were contrary to what the police said. We're seeing more and more that when there is video evidence, a lot of things that are written down on police reports that not only police officers involved in the incident say, but even other police officers who are bystanders, what they say is often not true. And so I'm hoping that we are starting to recognize that police officers are people too, and people lie all the time when their interests encourage them to, and when it's in their interest to lie. And so, but even with the video, Sonali, I will again caution us, even with the video like Rodney King's video and like some other video that we've seen through the years, you and I have had a lot of talks about the procession of hashtags that made up the Black Lives Matter movement 4 and 5 years ago. We saw a lot of that video not result in convictions because police still do enjoy a kind of halo that police officers from, years of us watching shows like Law and Order SUV, Law and Order, a lot of the pop, what some call propaganda that we've been absorbing as a country for 20, 30 years now, makes us almost reflexively sympathize and empathize with police officers more than those they're accused of assaulting.
Now, the Minneapolis Police Department has a very brutal history of racist policing, which is why there are these mass protests for 2 days now. I mean, for those of us outside Minneapolis, one may wonder at the overwhelming reaction. I mean, thousands upon thousands of people have been showing up in the streets, but it's because of George Floyd is not the first, but only the latest victim, right? And what's remarkable is, in spite of this video, although the four officers in question were promptly fired, so far there have been no arrests.
Yeah, and they were only all four fired because of activism earlier that in which some of the activists won the concession from the powers that be that not only police officers who perpetrate wrong, but those who stand idly by and watch and allow them to perpetrate wrong should also be subject to firing. So there was some progress in that respect, but we're still a long way from, do we have either a prosecution, and even if you have a charge, an arrest, and a prosecution, do you have a conviction? We're still a long way away from that. But there is some movement in that direction. And as you observe, as you point out, this latest incident was kind of like tearing away a scab that's covered a festering wound. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those wounds have been festering for a long time, and have this eruption is just evidence of that failure to heal those wounds from before and really increase the trust and confidence in the police department in the greater Minneapolis community again. And notice those protests in Minneapolis are multicultural, multiracial, and even multigenerational. You have a lot of people who recognize that the police department is broken and something needs to be done.
That's right. Very diverse protests. Minneapolis is not terribly diverse. So a lot of white residents showing up and holding up signs, facing off against police. And it should really be noted that the protests have been creative as well. There was one group that went outside the home of Derek Chauvin, who was the main police officer who had knelt down with his knee over George Floyd's neck, who was most directly responsible for the killing. And they hunkered down there. They stopped food delivery trucks from delivering food to the house. They held up signs. They were very clear that they wanted to point out that he couldn't continue with life as usual. But of course, the police response to the protesters was also instructive. Violent police responses. They used stun grenades and tear gas. Some of the scenes really look like they were out of a war zone. And there has been at least one casualty, not necessarily at the hands of the police so far. It seems as though a store owner killed another person. And it's not clear how they were connected to the protests, but at least one person has so far died in the protests against George Floyd's killings. Many people have pointed out, Jody, that the police response to the white anti-lockdown protests in other parts of the country stand in such stark contrast to how Minneapolis police responded to these protesters, the Black Lives Matter protesters.
The contrast is stark and telling between the response of police to mostly white protesters who were armed in many cases, who were shouting, sometimes shoving police officers, taunting them at close range because they were not going to be able to go and get barber care or weren't going to be able to avail themselves of some other amenities in many cases. Contrasting the response of police to them, which was restrained, patient, they exercised a lot of forbearance when it came to those protesters. On the other hand, when you had protesters who were protesting what was a flagrant injustice, brutal killing of a man who is gasping for air, echoing Eric Garner's "I Can't Breathe," and having those last gasps on the concrete with the knee on his neck. People who are protesting that kind of injustice are treated without restraint, without forbearance, without compassion, care, and concern, even, it would appear. And so again, that contrast, I think, is bringing home to people that this is not just an individualized problem. I think you're at the top of the show, Sonali, you made the point, and it's a very good one, that this George Floyd case seems to have really touched a nerve in many people in a way that even some of the earlier cases that were also horrible haven't touched the same kind of nerve. And I think part of the reason is the kind of cumulative effect, right? You have the first wave of the procession of hashtags that made up Black Lives Matter about 4 or 5 years ago. We saw a lot of injustices in the videos, and people gradually started to say, well, maybe these aren't individualized cases. They aren't separate, random acts. They aren't just a few bad apples. They're things that are happening in the South in places like Georgia with Ahmaud Arbery. They're happening in the Northeast in New York with someone like Amy Cooper and Christian Cooper. They're happening in the Midwest with somebody like George Floyd. They're happening on the West Coast. We just had not long ago a big protest here in LA with people who were taking to the streets and highways because the same kinds of problems are occurring out here on the West Coast. I think more people are starting to see this as a global national problem, not that's persistent and pervasive, and not just a few bad apples, not just a few isolated incidents, but something systemic and structural that's going to take a collective response, and we need a collective solution for it.
I want to connect the killing, the police killing of George Floyd with the New York City Central Park incident, because it isn't, of course, just racist policing. It's the weaponizing of racist policing by even folks who consider themselves liberal. This woman named Amy Cooper, who identified as a white, you know, as a liberal, she was a white woman who the video just shows the incredible way in which she lashed out at a man who simply asked her to leash her dog and follow park rules. And she you could see in the phone call she made to police, sounded more aggravated than she was, and just basically made up a fact that he was threatening her when he was clearly not threatening her. She was coming toward him, and he had to ask her to step back. And it, you know, she's of course now been publicly shamed. She's lost her job. Her dog got taken away from her. A lot of people were, you know, trying to sympathize with her, and she pointed out as so many people do, that she was not a racist. But what she did was a really racist thing, right? And for white liberals to weaponize racist policing against people of color, in particular Black people, I think also needs to be brought into the conversation.
Oh yeah, it's part of it for sure. There's a convergence of a lot of things that I think are raising people's awareness about the ubiquity of anti-Black bias in America. With Amy Cooper, you had someone who, before she called 911, clearly wasn't fearful, clearly wasn't scared. As you said, she approached him, Amy Cooper approached Christian Cooper, the Black male in the incident, and he had to back up and say, get away from me. And then when she got on 911, her voice became tremulous and she weaponized her whiteness. She weaponized her white womanness. She knew that if 911 hearing her with this shaky voice, with this fearful voice saying an African-American man is threatening me, that that would mobilize police in a way that nothing else would. And there was a direct line. You could see a direct line running from Christian Cooper, her call on Christian Cooper, and George Floyd. Because had the police arrived there and there hadn't been video of what happened before they arrived, and they took her word, as police and others often do in these kinds of cases, go back to the Scottsboro Boys, in which a white woman accused some Black youth of raping her, which was completely made up charge. Go back to Emmett Till.
Or even the Central Park Five, which in this particular case is very relevant given that Central Park.
Central Park is involved, spot on, right? And Emmett Till is, by the same token, a white woman saying a 14-year-old Black boy. So that there are a lot of times when white womanhood, not just whiteness, but white womanhood has been weaponized against Black men. And you could have very easily seen Christian Cooper with a knee on his neck as he gasped his last breaths and said, I can't breathe. And as you said, this was an otherwise liberal, probably would consider herself even a racially liberal, but certainly in her politics, liberal person. And so when it comes to thinking about racism and understanding racism, we have to understand racism as something that isn't just happening among KKK members or among, you know, people who are avowedly virulent in their racism. But racism, speaking of viruses, you know, has an ability like COVID-19 to affect people and not even be detected, you know, and mutate and take many different forms. And so at the same time, we're dealing with one kind of public health disaster and calamity, coronavirus. Hopefully we recognize that racism is another kind of public health problem and calamity, and we need to tackle them both in that spirit. And who's bearing the brunt of both those public health problems, that is COVID-19 and racism? Black folk, disproportionately, in both cases, right? If you are down here in LA, you walk down Skid Row here in LA, where we have the most maligned and marginalized citizens in America, 75% of Skid Row is Black. You know, you go into our prisons, which is the epicenter of COVID-19 right now, are the prisons. That's where it's really raging and boomeranging back on the general community, because guards and other people, prison personnel and jail personnel who work in those places, come into contact with people with COVID-19 in those sites and then come back into the general community and spread it. And people are coming out of the jail, churning in and out and spreading it. We're, again, disproportionately Black. So hopefully we recognize that, and I think more people are starting to, because of this George Floyd case and its connection with Ahmaud Arbery and Amy Cooper, are starting to recognize that we gotta stand together. We have to stand in solidarity. And you're really seeing that in the protests. You're seeing multi-generational, multi-ethnic protests, in which I see more solidarity than I've seen in a long time. And I hope it's partly a product of our recognition that we're going through something that is a generational upheaval right now with this COVID-19 crisis. And unless we stand together and pull together in some kind of way, it's going to be even more calamitous than anything we can imagine.
I want to also mention, of course, that Black women are victimized as well. And around the same time, an incident that just didn't get very much attention was in Michigan, in Ypsilanti, where a Black woman, she was with her husband. They were outdoors. There was a shooting that had taken place, and the police claimed that she refused to leave the scene. And there's a brutal beating also captured on video of this cop. They hurt both the woman and her husband, but the woman in particular punched repeatedly in the face. That story has not gotten very much attention. She did not die, thankfully. But that sort of brutality, of course, impacts Black women as well. And today we have a government at the federal level that is claiming to take seriously the George Floyd case. In fact, the Justice Department very early on in the case said that the FBI would be investigating, that they've prioritized it. They were going to perform a robust criminal investigation into this. But wasn't it under the previous Attorney General of Trump's, Jeff Sessions, that all of the consent decrees around holding police departments around the country accountable under the Obama administration, all of those had been undone? Sessions, very early on in Trump's presidency, took those apart, which essentially gave police around the country a green light. So how can we trust the Attorney General, William Barr, the current Attorney General, and Trump's Justice Department to do the right thing?
Yeah, we have to distinguish between lip service and actual policies that are trying to make a difference and improve conditions. You can remember Trump at one point saying, when he was talking in front of a lot of officers behind him, that I see you putting people into the back of cars and putting your hand on the heads of suspects as you're putting them in the back of cars. I don't think you need to put your hands, to cover their heads as you're putting them in the back of cars. Really encouraging more of that kind of police brutality, encouraging a callous indifference for us citizens. And one of the key things to remember, Sonali, when we're talking about these cases, is people always want to trot out the old canard about why are you focusing on blue on black violence when there is so much Black on Black violence that claims so many more lives than blue on Black violence. You often hear that. You've heard it before. You're going to hear it again. And there's one really simple, quick answer to that. And I think a whole lot more Americans of all races are starting to see through it. And that is, police officers act under color of law on our behalf. When they do wrong as state actors, they implicate all of us. They put the blood of their victims on the hands of all of us. Chief Charlie Beck, when he was chief here in LA some time ago, used to say, well, when you attack a police officer, you're attacking America. Well, by the same token, Chief Beck or whatever other chief who's in office who's saying that same thing, when a police officer attacks an innocent Black person, that's America attacking that innocent Black person. You don't get to be America when you're a victim and just treated like an ordinary citizen when you're a victimizer. That's America with its knee on George Floyd's neck as he's saying, I can't breathe, and gasping his last breath on the concrete. That's America who's shooting Breonna Taylor. That's a Black woman in Louisville who in a no-knock raid was killed. Fortunately, her boyfriend wasn't, but she was killed. That didn't make the news very much. That was America down in the Ahmaud Arbery case, who was standing in the shoes of those prosecutors saying, we don't see anything here that we need to bring charges about. So that I think there's much more of a recognition that we are collectively accountable for the behavior of those who act on our behalf, namely our police department.
Finally, Jody, I want to ask you about the debate that takes place around just the viewing of these traumatizing videos. On the one hand, we talked about early in our conversation how the mere fact that the videos exist helps to tear down the police's credibility when they continually make false claims to try to justify the murders. On the other hand, the continual watching of these videos, the sharing, the spreading, To many folks is deeply triggering, justifiably so, deeply re-traumatizing. And some even say can help to numb us to the dehumanization of Black Americans. Where do you stand on this issue? How should we approach the viewing of these videos, to watch them or not watch them? We've tried on our program to very minimally show them or to warn viewers and listeners about them, because we also don't want to re-traumatize folks.
Yeah, it is triggering. It is traumatizing a lot of times, Sonali. As a Black person, as a human being, I would hope, but especially as a Black person who has Black sons and daughters, who you worry about when they walk out of the door, are they going to be on the receiving end of this? It is traumatizing, but I don't know of any other way, as traumatizing as it is, to get the message across. There are people who've been reached through the George Floyd video who would not have been reached otherwise. Emmett Till's mother insisted on having an open casket in Chicago when they brought his body back, so that people would have to walk by and see his ravaged, destroyed, torn apart body, and see what racism had wrought with her son. You know, my forthcoming book, the reason I call my book coming out in August, Nigger Theory, Race, Language, Unequal Justice and Law, the reason I use that barbed, blood-stained epithet, N-word, in my title and in my discussion is because no other word helps us to see how much we otherize Black people, how much we demonize and monsterize them so often, and don't feel the kind of kinship, connection that we otherwise should, that if we did, we would do more to keep them from being on the receiving end of these kinds of brutal encounters. But yeah, it is unfortunate, but a necessary evil. And even as I say that, I feel uncomfortable, Sonali, because it turns my stomach. I hate to have to watch it sometimes, but I know I have no choice because I'm doing this for my children. I'm doing it for my grandchildren. And it doesn't seem that anything else is reaching people. I know there's a voyeuristic element. I know there's a, you know, pornographic element in it for many people, but nothing else seems to be getting the job done. So it's just a very sad, unnecessary evil.
Jody, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and discussing these critically important issues. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Sonali, always.
My guest is Jody Armour. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California, and he is also our race and criminal justice correspondent. We've been discussing recent incidents of racist police brutality, including against George Floyd in Minneapolis and Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.